Hello, everybody. Welcome to episode 8 of Topical Fever. My name is David Parsons, and I thank you very much for listening to the podcast. If you are interested in what you're hearing, you can find more on my Twitter feed, at David L. Parsons, or by searching Topical Fever on Twitter. And you will find all sorts of links to relevant news items and all kinds of blatant, ridiculous, and probably indefensible statements from me throughout the day. So if that's the kind of thing that interests you, then please check me out on Twitter. This week, I am talking with a couple of folks that I work with at the Bernard L. Schwartz Communication Institute at Baruch College. The Schwartz Institute is a place that encourages and emphasizes the use of oral and written and computer-mediated communication across all curriculum at Baruch College, and a place that I think of as kind of a think tank for communication and technology and its use in higher education. So many of you may know that I teach American history at Baruch College, and education is obviously a big part of my life. But if you're not in education, you're not in higher education, you may not be aware of how tremendous a crisis there is in higher education these days. That crisis has a lot of different elements going on, too complicated to get into right now, and I'll certainly post some links on the blog that help explain what's going on. But the main idea is that I would say the main element of the crisis is that higher education is being defunded by state governments at a rate that's never been seen before, and that defunding is referred to as austerity and has obviously more to do with not just about education, but either way, austerity is impacting education tremendously, and the result is obviously a cheapening of the educational experience. At the same time, tuition is going up, so students are paying for an experience that is less, and faculty is being cut. Resources are being cut, and there's a general feeling of panic among both faculty and administration during this period. So today, the particular angle I wanted to talk about with it was technology and what role technology might play within that unfolding drama of austerity in higher education. There's a lot of fear and there's a lot of hope placed in digital technology and what role it might play. This conversation covers a lot of territory, particularly things like MOOCs, which stands for massively open online courses. If you don't know what a MOOC is, we'll describe what those are and how they represent both a fear and a hope for both educators and students. The two folks that I brought in to talk today are people that I've been lucky enough to work with for several years at the Schwartz Institute. One is Mikhail Gershovich, who's the director of the Institute, and Luke Walzer, who's the Assistant Director for Educational Technology. Both of these gentlemen know a great deal about this subject and are very articulate and are very passionate about spreading the word about technology, about communication, and I think they have a really appealing kind of humanist element to what they're saying. And so this conversation goes through we talk about different projects that Luke and Mikhail have done, have been involved with at the center, and we have a kind of theoretical discussion about the fear, and what is the fear is that the college experience is going to be replaced by an online experience, and that's something that only educators can help direct and can help prevent, I should say, because otherwise the forces of evil, and I would locate them, in not only state governments but in on boards of trustees at universities across the land, if they have their way, they would digitize the experience and take away some of those social elements. So I realize this is a complicated conversation, and Luke and Mikhail certainly have their own viewpoints on it. So we had a nice discussion, and I hope you enjoy this episode of Topical Fever. I think the thought I had originally when I wanted to do an episode about technology and education was that I use technology and education obviously a lot, and I like blogs, wikis, and that kind of stuff. And I think it's kind of foolish to think that students aren't going to use the internet and use computers and their phones and everything else in order to get through their education. But there's also there seems to be something brewing, or at least there's some fear that technology could be used as a tool of austerity, right? Mm-hmm. That there could be, as much as we're promoters of a kind of rich pedagogy, there's also forces in government and in administration that would like to use technology to cut teachers yeah. and cut stuff.
Well, that's where the whole MOOC conversation's been moving.
Right.
Seems like.
Right. And so, what is a MOOC, by the way? I always knew the word MOOC as a slur from the Martin Scorsese movie Mean Streets, but now MOOC has become. I guess it's still a slur in a certain way.
Mookie from Do the Right Thing.
Right. Right. And Mookie from Do the Right Thing. That's right. MOOC is a massive online open. Massively open online course. So for people that don't know what a MOOC is, maybe you could explain.
Okay.
This is Luke Walzer, by the way.
The terminology for a MOOC emerged in 2008 by some Canadian gentlemen, Stephen Downes and Dave Cormier and George Siemens, mm-hmm. who were very interested in exploring the possibilities of networked open learning experiments. And mm-hmm. So they led what they termed a MOOC. That brought together instructional technologists from all around the world to talk about trends in online teaching and online instruction. And the theory behind what they were doing has now kind of evolved into what is called a connectivist MOOC, a CMOOC. Mm. And the idea is that technology can lower the barriers to conversation and create easy opportunities for people from all around the world mm-hmm, and who have mm-hmm. a variety of experiences to connect and to learn and to have conversations. They were by design messy. Mm-hmm. They were by design decentralized and distributed and were integrated into the people who participated in them into their own personal networks.
Okay.
Right? So that was the notion of a CMOOC, connectivist MOOC. They started it. Other folks have picked up and run with it, including our friends at University of Mary Washington, who have a digital storytelling MOOC called DS106, which is built along a similar model. There's a very interesting project out of the University of Nebraska at Lincoln called the History Harvest, mm-hmm, which mm-hmm. connects various history classrooms doing local public history in their own communities with one another through this connectivist pedagogical model.
Okay, right? And so you have basically a whole lot of people, and sometimes that can be 10,000, 20,000 people.
The connectivist MOOCs tend to be by necessity smaller. Uh-huh. They tend 100. To be closer to the number of people who actually stick with the ex-MOOCs,
right,
which
right.
are the ones you're talking about. Which
okay,
are
yeah. So and the ones I'm talking about are, you know, probably because I've read some of these alarmist blogs, articles, editorials, whatever. Because this is a significant debate going on right now about MOOCs and about the direction of technology as it's employed and how it changes the way we learn. But there's the blogs that I've read have had this kind of alarmist tone, right? They're
right.
Like, this is a class where 10,000 people are taking a class at home, maybe 2.5% of them actually complete it, mm-hmm. and none of this is for those who don't know what a MOOC is. None of this is for a college credit necessarily.
Not yet.
Well, not yet. In some places, they are starting to take college credits for completed ex-MOOCs, and the ex-MOOCs are distinct from the CMOOCs in a few different ways, in that they are not decentralized. They're centralized around platforms like Coursera mm-hmm. or edX or Udacity,
yeah. Right, right.
Which are the course management systems whose primary innovation is the scale that they allow, right? So they're not housed in any one particular institution. Anyone can have access to them, unlike Blackboard, where you have to be mm-hmm, placed into. Mm-hmm. But they're very similar. They function like Blackboard functions.
Okay.
They have kind of out-of-the-box course management functionality. Post your syllabus here. You have some control over the information architecture.
And students watch video.
Students primarily watch videos, but they also participate in peer assessments, mm-hmm. The quality of which, and I've looked at a bunch of these, they range drastically from very kind of interesting prompts that students have to respond to,
mm-hmm.
and then four of their classmates will give them feedback on the prompts based on a rubric that the faculty member designs, to very unsophisticated prompts. You know, tell us about the book you read last week.
Right, right.
Most of them exist on a content delivery model where there's a faculty member who gives a video lecture or a series of video lectures over the course of the class. They range in from 10 to 15 minutes and they accompany a reading. Mm-hmm. And the students are supposed to kind of follow along. There's a forum where students can post questions which may or may not be responded to. And that's the kind of basic model for these ex-MOOCs. And their primary innovation is in that they have allowed these experiences to scale. So now 100,000 people can register for a course.
Right, there's something very appealing about that for people that are, you know, concerned about college being an elite kind of experience, and there's something about I don't know, the same kind of hopes you put on the internet for anything else is that there's a democratizing impulse, right? And there's a sense that more people will have access to something that they didn't before. But do you think that's necessarily true?
I think as courses, they make really good TV shows. And I think you can get good lectures that are interesting. I mean, this is also not new. I mean, NYU did something from the late 50s to the early 80s called the Sunrise Semester. Every Saturday morning at 8 o'clock, you'd get an hour lecture on Proust or on Kafka.
And how did you get that?
It was on CBS Channel 2, and you could tune in. You can do the reading for the next week, and they're eerily similar to the type of content you're seeing from.
But at the same time, it's obviously a much more. There's a much more a bigger engagement with it now by schools and companies. And when I say companies, is this part of privatizing education? Is this what the fear is with MOOCs?
There's a lot of venture capital in MOOCs these days. To speak to your earlier question about the kind of democratization, there's I think it's the University of California at Fresno that's running a pilot where they're allowing students to take MOOCs for credit, and they're cheaper than regular courses. So it's like $150 for a course if you take it on a MOOC, and it's like whatever it is, $500
right,
if you take it
right.
As a matriculated student traditionally.
And you know, it makes me, because I guess what I wanted to get to is what is the value of the MOOC as compared to a traditional education? I don't want to frame the whole conversation about MOOCs, obviously, but that's kind of where we're.
That's where the conversation is, and I think if you're asking what the value is, you have to ask the value for whom, right? For a faculty member who has a genuine interest in teaching in a new platform, or to come up with new pedagogical questions, or to reach a potential broader base of students, someone who may not be up on all the kind of innovative trends in educational technology and may not be facile with the technology themselves, but talking about a Harvard professor or somebody who wants a broader audience and thinks that their ideas are worth exposing to a broader constituency, you can see the appeal of a platform like this. For university administrators who see this as a way to extend branding and to extend the brand of their university throughout the world, you can see the appeal.
Right.
And also in terms of space, which is a big issue, because it doesn't take a whole lot of space to run a MOOC. Right. So one of the reasons that Baruch is interested in online courses is because there's a space crunch.
Yeah.
And
right.
It's one way to work to alleviate it.
Interesting.
Baruch isn't interested in MOOCs yet, though. They're interested in online education.
Online courses in general, right.
Coursera estimates that it costs between $50,000 and $100,000 to actually produce a MOOC.
Wow.
And if you look at a MOOC, you'll see where all the production costs are going.
Uh-huh.
The videos are very well shot.
Right.
You generally have a TA or two who's manning or womaning the forum, so there's some labor costs involved. And then there's, you know, each of the kind of the details of the contracts with the universities and Coursera. There was a report in Inside Higher Ed saying that Coursera has expressly I'm committed to only partnering with elite universities, right? So there's clearly something going on there with brand recognition and with the desire to have Coursera cloaked in this kind of notion of what an elite American education means. All of this says, you know, nothing about the perspective of students, right?
Right. That's either the students. I kind of want to get to
the students at the institutions that are devoting resources to producing these things. Most often aren't served. You don't see students from Harvard taking a Harvard MOOC course.
Right.
They get those faculty members in person.
Yeah, they're still an elite, maybe even a shrinking elite then, that gets to actually take the courses and actually talk to the professor and have interactions with students beyond just on a internet discussion board or on their phone or something like that.
Right. To a certain extent, I think the ex-MOOC, I mean, I think it's the recent attention that's gone over the past year is it's a bubble. Ultimately,
it's an attention bubble.
It's an attention and a focus bubble. Yeah. And to the extent that these are not going to be profitable for universities.
Yeah.
They're not going to be, and they're also not going to be, not going to provide educations that are accessible and therefore accreditable.
Right.
Well, that remains to be seen, though, don't you think? I mean, it just seems like they will have to be some sort of, I don't know, adapting to MOOCs on the part of accrediting agencies, because they seem to be this experiment in California with the MOOCs for credit. I think that's going to play into it.
Yeah, there was a big uproar about that a couple weeks ago, right? On like Chronicle of Higher Education, I get all these alerts, right? There's something going on in California, and it was that the University of California, was it the UC system?
It's one of the schools. I think it's Fresno, but okay. I could be wrong about that.
Changing the way they provide credit, and particularly giving credit to MOOCs. Or this format of education. So, you know, I was talking to Claudia, my wife, about this the other day, and we were talking about college as a social experience, and I don't mean like parties and frat boys and things like that, although maybe that plays into it a little bit. But there's also just the phenomenon of being in a classroom and being with other people and seeing the face and the body of your professor and interacting with him or her and interacting with other students and where does that go with the MOOC if we make if we make education, I mean, maybe that's where the split is, and I know I'm bringing up a lot of stuff here, but maybe that's where the split is that with the, you know, math and science and the technical skills, it seems like more natural to do online stuff. Not that you don't need a social experience to learn math and science, but the humanities is got by nature a more abstracted kind of discipline, and that does require a little more of a social touch. I could be wrong there.
Yeah, I mean, I one of the students who is in my ITP course at the Graduate Center. We were talking about MOOCs, and she was a former high school math teacher, and she's. Her experience taught her that in-person instruction for math is absolutely necessary. You need to be able to sit with students and to explain things to them in 5, 6, 8, 10 different ways.
Right.
There's still the kind of humanity is not extracted from the experience of learning math. But I think it's important to not necessarily conflate MOOCs with online education.
Okay,
we should understand that they're two different things. And within online education, there's a kind of a variety of ways to understand that. Many of which have socialization as core components.
Right. So you have like I would speak for all of us in saying that there's something appealing about a hybrid kind of path, right? That between the social experience and the technology kind of integrated, and that's why maybe there's a fear about MOOCs, because it's the fear that you'll lose that social experience and kind of replace it with just an online experience.
I think that's always been the kind of, you know, fear, trepidation around online instruction anyway, right? That it's just, this is happening at a different scale.
Yeah, and you know, I just watched this RSA Animate, which I'll post on the blog when I post this episode. Sir Ken Robinson.
Yeah.
And he doesn't really even mention technology that much. The context of his conversation is that education is changing regardless, right? Mm-hmm. We're in the middle of kind of a worldwide revolutionary moment for education. There are a lot of factors at play, mainly globalization, and the kind of For him, the kind of educational paradigms that were created by or during the Age of Enlightenment, right, to foster the Industrial Revolution and start this kind of project, are outmoded, and that and again, he doesn't frame this with digital technology so much as I think you know, political economy. But either way, he's saying that, like, you know, that kind of old school conception of education, the kind of chalkboard lecture discussion kind of model, is something that needs to be intervened on in a much more radical way, mm-hmm. Whether technology is involved in it or not. So right. There's something to that too. But go ahead. What are you going to say?
I was going to say, I mean, I don't the business model implications of MOOCs, I think, are important, especially given the context of the massive defunding of public higher education in the United States over the past 5 years. The Center for Budget Policy and Analysis put out a report last week which showed state-by-state defunding, which is something you should definitely post on your site. Mm-hmm. And there are two states that have increased funding over the past
five years.
I believe Alaska and North Dakota. It's related to oil money.
Right.
They have a lot of money in their coffers.
There's an imperative there.
Every other state has reduced funding per student by at least 15%, up to Arizona and California, which are approaching 50% reductions in funding. So I think
tuitions have been increasing in the University of California by like 33% in the last.
Yeah, year. Tuition is increasing in response to this massive defunding.
Uh-huh.
Right. So there's all this the rhetoric around MOOCs and the Tom Friedman pieces about how they're revolutionizing higher education. They tend to miss that part of the context, and that there's this open space because we as a society have decided that this is not something that we value enough to invest in.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's a crucial component of the context for MOOCs.
Yeah, I mean, that's the kind of the essence of the tightrope we're walking, I think, as educators, which is that we're all people that want to use and promote technology as a truly revolutionary tool in education, but at the same time, we don't want to walk into a trap, right?
Yeah.
An austerity trap.
Yeah, and it sometimes makes us sad, those of us who for the past 10, 15 years have seen experimenting with emerging educational technologies, especially at a place with CUNY, like mm-hmm. CUNY, with its historical mission to you know, give people an opportunity to experience college for the first time in their family's history. We very much see the work that we're doing experimenting with these tools as experiments in empowerment. I mean, we really want to put students and CUNY students in control of their own spaces in which they're experiencing these courses.
And I think that's why there's so much kind of I guess negative energy from a lot of educators towards MOOCs, because you feel that it's not doing that, mm-hmm. right? You feel that it's not integrating technology in a way that empowers students. Instead, it's kind of using technology as a way to get away from that.
Almost. Yeah. It also kind of mirrors some of the pathways debates here at CUNY, and that MOOCs for the elite institutions of higher education are ways to bypass faculty control of curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
Faculty aren't approving the MOOCs that happen. Faculty who teach these massive open online courses often don't get them as part of their loads.
Yeah,
they're doing them purely as experiments, purely for the benefit of the institution. But they have the university brand on them, mm-hmm. right? So they are being affiliated with the university's curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
Many faculty are up in arms about that.
You know, the implications for governance are really interesting. You know, I don't think that's really been discussed all that much.
What do you mean by that?
Well, what Luke's talking about in terms of faculty control of what exactly happens. And it seems like that's one way of taking the control away from the faculty. And it's always been a sticking point. Governance is always something that faculty really fight for, that the administration sort of sees as sometimes problematic, and it's always a sticking point. So the implications of MOOCs for that kind of thing are really fascinating too, for some reasons that Luke brought up.
Yeah, I mean, so how do we as people that work at colleges in various capacities, and we're concerned about this, how do we kind of drive the conversation on on technology? I mean, is it something that we have the is it maybe something we have with our students? Is it something we do as by example?
Yeah, that's what we've
like,
been.
Look, this is how it should be done.
That's what we've been doing. I mean, why we built an open publishing platform for the college to give people an alternative for exploring these spaces, one that empowers them to control their own experience in the space,
right.
To take their content with them, to shape the spaces as they want. That is very much at the heart of the mission behind Blogs at Baruch and shares much with open source software development, and that you should be free to do with this stuff what you want to do with it.
Yeah, and that actually links up with the Ken Robinson thing, because that's what he's suggesting, is like whatever direction we need to go with education, whether it uses technology or not. Obviously, I think we're going to be using technology. We have to be honoring each individual student's own kind of path, and that sounds like maybe like. I don't know, a remnant of the 1960s, like individualism or something, but it's more about kind of recognizing that these kind of broad cultural identities that we want to bring into the academy have to be honored in a way that's beyond the way they've been before. It can't be a white elite institution anymore. Yeah. It has to be, and the internet can make it can help make it not that, if that makes sense.
Part of it. Part of the process requires you asking a bit more of your students and your faculty members,
right?
Rather than giving them a tool that only works in one way and asking them to force their teaching and learning into that space, you give them a tool that they have control over, but then they have to ask themselves, well, how do I want to use this, right? And there's all sorts of pedagogical implications to blank open spaces that faculty members then have to shape to their own purposes,
right?
But we think those are good experiences for a community to have. There's lots of ancillary learning and conversations about it. The ethics of open learning environments, about intellectual property implications of teaching and learning in this space, that are the grist for engagement in the future of technology and higher education, for a community to be involved in those conversations.
Yeah, I mean, what I'm kind of hearing is that there's like, I got a speeding ticket, you know, years ago and had to take a driver's education course, right? And so you take these like online classes and it's on like, you know, Maryland's particular laws. And I'm just clicking through, and I think, you know, I think that a lot of people think of online education that way. They think it's like something that you can just click through and get your certificate at the end. But what you guys are talking about, what Luke is talking about doing at the Schwartz Institute, is kind of developing a pedagogy or a way of teaching, a way of presenting material and having students collaborate. That's much more, I don't know, takes almost a template of social media in a sense, and makes it something that is not just clicking through and getting your certificate and not learning.
Yeah, it's envisioning students as makers, right? I mean, that's what Mikhail's experiments with invention in the classroom.
Can you talk about that, Mikhail? Because I love this. This is the 3D printer thing, right?
Yeah, it's related to that.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, this actually works well with what Luke's been talking about. We one of the approaches that we've been taking over the years is to try to I don't know if replicate's the best term, but to provide context for learning, especially writing and oral communication that resemble real practical contexts that students may find themselves in. And one sort of related idea is to get students talking and thinking about stuff that is exciting to them. Mm-hmm. Stuff that's new, that engages them as makers, as creators, as thinkers. And one of the directions we've been moving with that kind of stuff is we've been playing around with some of the kind of basics of maker culture. So the CIO got us a 3D printer, and we had a professor named Erica Kaufman, who you know well.
Yes.
Who is asking her students to design. She has a whole unit on I can't remember. Do you remember the specifics of the unit last semester where the students did the stuff with the brain?
It was a learning community with a biology class, and it was like bioethics.
Right. So she had students design objects that spoke to the various assignments that they were doing, and they wrote about the process of designing, and they wrote about the stuff that they designed and why, and then they designed that stuff using free software, and they printed them. printed.
Great.
They're the artifacts that they created.
They actually made the
they
object.
They made them, and then they presented on them, mm-hmm. and they had
so
the objects
in front of them. They're creating something. They're talking about creating it. They're sharing it with it's really cool.
And
it's
writing about it.
Right.
Yeah, writing about it.
And it's using a kind of it reminds me again of the Ken Robinson thing, because he talks about the impulses that the very young children have, that if you that there's a test that if you give someone a paperclip and ask them to come up with a certain number of uses for that paperclip, that children are actually better at this and more imaginative than older people. And they say they tested the same children in kindergarten, and they did worse when they were 10 years old, right? They did worse later because they'd been kind of regimented in their way of thinking, to the point where their imaginative properties had actually lessened and been restricted. And the argument then is that there, in public education, or in the way we've kind of streamlined education or structured it, we end up with students losing something, or kids losing some of their genius properties that they had when they were little kids. And I like that maker thing, because it brings that back in a sense.
Yeah.
And it's not an arts and crafts class. This is, I want to be careful about, this is like pretty serious humanities type stuff.
Right. And it's also not just about making stuff. It's about making stuff in the context of mm-hmm. of scaffolded assignments mm-hmm. that get them writing, get them speaking.
Right.
So they're writing more kind of formal reflections. They're writing blog posts. They're presenting to their class about it. One student had a very intricate, sophisticated PowerPoint presentation mm-hmm. around the project that he printed. It was really, really well done. It gets students one of the things that's been kind of my my hobby horse here for a while is you want to get students to sort of feel a sense of agency.
Yeah, right.
And you want students to feel empowered to create. They're not just responding to what the professor asked them to do, but they're making something that is in some part theirs.
Uh-huh.
And there's a concept of ownership in composition, and it's an idea that's sort of fallen out of favor because of the economic metaphor
mm-hmm.
Inherent in it. But the idea that you want students to feel as though they, quote, own their writing,
right.
own their work. It's theirs, not just in response to assignment. It might be, but it's also something that's uniquely theirs, mm-hmm. That they've crafted, they've created. And so we want to give students opportunities to do that kind of thing. And one of the I don't know if you saw this, but one of the things that we did was we used a microcontroller called the Makey Makey, which is based on the Arduino technology. And what it does is it allows anything conductive plugged into it to act as a key on the keyboard.
Uh-huh.
And so if you connect that to whatever programs you can find on the internet or that are installed on your computer, it can do all kinds of really sophisticated, complicated stuff. So like, for example, imagine you could have a painting of a house that's done in a conductive paint, and it's tied to home control software. And every time you touch the window in the house on the painting, the real light in the window goes on.
Right.
And that's one of the ways we explain this to students. So we gave students a bunch of makey makeys. We gave them a bunch of arts and crafts stuff. We gave them a bunch of fruit, which is really, which works well because it's conductive.
Yeah, I saw the banana piano,
all that kind of stuff. And we had them invent stuff. And and one group, this kind of blew me away. One group made an interactive map of the five boroughs, that every time you touched a name of a borough, it would play a hip hop song associated mm-hmm. with that mm-hmm. borough.
Yeah,
so that was the case for all the boroughs except Manhattan, which got a car horn because they couldn't think of a Manhattan
right,
rapper.
Right.
Puff Daddy came up before, right?
That's right. So have you gotten feedback about these experiments? Because this is really exciting stuff to me. And I hear voices in my head that both the Stanley Fish, it's like, what are you doing with this stuff? They need to be reading, you know, the Odyssey, and that's what they need to be doing, is reading the Odyssey and writing about it. And we need to get back to the classics. I hear both sides of that. But have you gotten feedback on this stuff?
Yeah, the ticker came, the school newspaper came, and they uh-huh. were really excited about it. The right. students loved it. They posted their reflections, and this was two classes worth of reflections. There was something like 60 blog posts about this. And of course, the folks at Joy Labs, which is the company that makes the Makey Makey, you have a Google alert.
Yes.
And they emailed Erica
Because they saw it on Twitter, right?
No, they saw all these blog posts.
Okay, yeah.
And they wrote a really nice
Google email. People are searching the internet very, very carefully to see right. if people are using their stuff.
But they found these blog posts. They were fascinated to read them, and they said it was the most creative use of their little thing that they've
That's great.
They've
this,
seen.
This the projects that Mikhail describes really speaks to the notion that students, especially at a place like Baruch, and we had this conversation in mm-hmm. at a staff meeting, need to be given permission to use all the things in their lives that make them interesting
yes.
in an academic
yes.
setting. And we have the most diverse student body in North uh-huh. America, students with all sorts of experiences. But for some reason, mostly reasons of race and class, mm-hmm. they think that those experiences and the knowledge that is derived from them are out of bounds for what they do in
yeah,
the classroom.
Yeah, I mean, there's an impulse towards like a real standardization of speech and everything else.
Right,
yeah.
And a lot of the things that we've been doing, the Makey experiment, what we've done with the Freshman Seminar Project, where all of our students are blogging about the processes of identity formation,
mm-hmm.
Are oriented around empowering them to rely upon their own identities
mm-hmm.
In their scholarly progression.
Right.
Right. These are the things that are going to make these students successful in life, whether they learn it here or they ultimately learn it when they go out into the workforce, mm-hmm. they need mm-hmm. to learn it. And the more opportunities we have to kind of to reinforce and to create structures for them to reflect upon how they've come to be here, the more empowered they're going to be as
yeah.
learners.
Yeah.
So that kind of filters through a lot of what we do.
Yeah, and that's the distinction. This is Kathy Davidson distinction between instructional technology and digital learning.
Okay.
Digital learning is about the stuff that Luke's talking about.
Mm-hmm.
It's about using digital tools in ways that connect to students' lives. The students use digital tools to reflect on the world around them,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to a focus on just the platforms or on the particular tools like, you know, cameras and
mm-hmm.
you know, whatever else.
Right.
Blackboard, the typical kind of ed tech tools, where the emphasis is really on the way these things integrate into students' lives.
Mm. So I suspect we're going to see, you know, a greater engagement with technology in kind of all these ways as we move forward, right? Is that we're going to see it being used in awful ways that really kind of offend us as educators, in ways that, and also in ways that are incredibly inspiring, right? That there's like it really feels it, when I hear you talk about the Making project, and even like the Blogs at Baruch thing, you guys had this you had this this thing where you had the students introduce themselves by making playlists. Is that right?
That was one of the freshman seminar writing prompts.
So in
freshman seminar, which has about 1,200 students at Baruch every fall, every individual section of freshman seminar, which has 20 students apiece, there's a blog affiliated with that seminar. The peer mentors and instructors who run the seminar have a conversation with the students about whether they want their blog to be public or private. If it's public, it's then fed into what we call the freshman seminar mother blog.
Mm.
So you can go to One Space on Blogs at Baruch. We'll share the URL through David's site and see all of the blog posts written by these incoming freshmen. And Mikhail and I last summer rewrote the three prompts that students are required. Can you pull up the prompts so I can read them explicitly?
These were really cool.
The three prompts that students are required to respond to over the course of their semester in a way that has them go out into the web and find some digital media that relates to their processes of identity formation, and to write 500 words or so about it, right? So it becomes a way for students to get to know each other,
mm-hmm.
Which is crucially important.
In a familiar way, too, right. In a sense. It's kind of what I love about this is that it takes something that young people are doing, right? Social media, something that's often, I think, kind of derided as a narcissistic development in culture, right? Is that everyone's on Facebook and Twitter and Spotify and whatever, kind of making this identity and talking about themselves all the time. But what's cool about this and what I liked about it is that it takes that impulse and something that may be derided as narcissistic and it turns it into something that's a real practice, right? Mm-hmm. It turns it into something where, okay, why did you post that on Facebook? Mm-hmm. You know, let's explore that. And all of a sudden it became the things that students are doing already, which is, you know, posting statuses and Twitter, you know, tweets and things like that. It turns it into something that is a kind of interrogative process of identity formation where you're like, you're actually looking at, okay, why am I doing this, and what does it mean that I am? And that engagement becomes out of something they're already doing, I think, is a brilliant way to like kind of start the conversation and start them on a kind of more advanced level of humanities. Mm-hmm.
Who do you think you are, and why do you think you are that?
Mm-hmm. And how many different ways can you express that? Right, we can express it in prose, we can express it with paint. Right, yeah. And students are encouraged to do that.
Are you finding the prompts?
Yeah. Create a 2-minute video, an 8-image slideshow, or a 10-song musical playlist that represents who you think you are to your classmates. Embed your creation in a blog post and then write 500 words that explains how you've created speaks to who you are, how what you've created speaks to who you are. Here's some tools that you can explore to do this assignment. So that's the first prompt.
Mm-hmm.
The second prompt, students have written a monologue as part of a monologue writing workshop in freshman seminar. So for the second prompt, they have to post the monologue that they've developed in their seminar and embed a self-portrait, which can be a photograph, an image, a cartoon, or a drawing, or some other description of how you see yourself.
Right.
And then the third prompt at the end of the semester is create or find a photograph or some other image, a meme, an animated GIF, that represents in some way your experience at Baruch thus far. Embed your image in a blog post in which you reflect in 500 words or so on your impressions of your first 3 months at Baruch.
Wow. I mean, yeah, I thought to myself when I read those prompts, I'm like, I wish I had gone to school during a time like this, because I really feel like it's funny, because on the one hand you have this like a very, very dire kind of situation that people are talking about in education right now with austerity and everything else, right? But on the other hand, you have it's actually kind of like this weird opportunity opening up. Yeah. That is tremendous.
Yeah.
And it's not going to be led by administration.
Well, it's good. There's going to be conflict, and the conflict in higher education is permanent.
I should amend that. It is going to be led by administration and faculty, but I think it's something that it's going to be a conversation, yeah. Right?
It has to be a conversation. Well, at the best universities, it's a conversation. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that dichotomy is problematic.
I mean,
it's a real one that's manifest in all kinds of, mm-hmm. of significant and you know, important ways, but it's one that's very troublesome, because it's unnecessary.
Yeah.
I feel like, you know, a lot of these decisions are being made top down, mm-hmm. like pathways, and that's reinforcing that dichotomy that a lot of folks have been fighting against.
Right, right.
But it's so pervasive that whenever you have, for example, like here, for example, you have members of the faculty become administrators, they're in some departments, they're immediately kind of seen as the enemy. And mm-hmm. that's deeply, deeply problematic.
Yeah.
And I think we could really answer a lot of these important questions together, mm-hmm. as administrators, mm-hmm. and faculty members, if we kind of set aside these silly hierarchies and dichotomies,
right.
And try to solve these sort of problems. But in some ways, because of the nature of higher education and the nature of department politics, people are invested in those kinds of things.
Yeah.
And it's really, really kind of troubling to see. It's like, it's almost as though they can't help themselves.
Yeah.
You know, they have to invoke these sorts of, well, you don't understand what we're saying because you're not a faculty member.
Yeah,
anymore,
yeah. It's kind of this old labor management type thing that I think you're right, obscures a lot. Really, I mean, what we're talking about is I think everybody's interested in raising educational standards somehow and using technology to do that, but no one's settled on exactly how that's going to be. I think that people like you guys here, and I would include myself even at the Schwartz Institute, have a feeling that the hand of the professor, or I don't even say the hand, but the spirit of the professor has to be stood up for in some way, meaning that we have to be the ones that are guiding this technology in a sense, and creating templates that make sure that it doesn't just become a driver's education course, mm-hmm. and something that you just kind of check off, and in a certain sense that we'd be doing this Whether the internet had happened or not, right?
Yeah. Well, to a certain extent, I mean, I agree with you 100%. You asked about the digital humanities earlier, and one of the reasons that the digital humanities has exploded over the past few years is that the barriers to doing it because of technological evolution have been lowered. It's now much easier to data mine a corpus of text than it was 20 years ago. You don't need the same level of technological know-how. You still need sophisticated methodologies, right?
Mm-hmm.
But now more people are being able to engage in the conversation. The same is true of platforms like Blogs at Baruch, alternative to course management systems, which up until 10 years ago, you needed pretty significant technological know-how to launch. You still need some. I mean, we need a system administrator, and we need people who know what they're doing, adding code to our server.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a more intensified conversation. There's more resources available in terms of knowledge.
It's changed everything, in a sense. Both Luke and I were in the history department at the CUNY Graduate Center at a moment that I think was kind of a unique moment in history, in that we're both in the history department, and our professors didn't get their PhDs, didn't write their dissertations with the internet at all. And I got a certain degree of jealousy from my advisor, who was like, you don't know what I had to do in order to do humanities work in the early 80s, mm-hmm. or the late 70s, that finding this kind of information would have been either impossible or very, very, very difficult. Mm-hmm. And that when I think about them typing up their dissertations on typewriters, it almost seems like I wouldn't even have done this if I hadn't have digital technology.
I had an experience when I was working on my dissertation where I needed an old journal that was only at the College of Staten Island, and I got my car, I drove to College of Staten Island. It was horrible rain. It was really awful. It was just terrible.
It's a long trip out there.
I was living in Brooklyn at the time, and it was just really awful trip. And then I got to the library, and I sat in front of this microfiche, or maybe it was a microfilm, which is even worse.
Yeah.
Sat in front of this thing, and went through this document, or this journal, kind of scanned it, looking for particular terms that I needed. Went through, I maybe got through the first, I don't know, 10 issues of it.
Uh-huh.
It's from 1922. And it was just, and I printed a bunch of really horrible copies.
Yes,
from
it
was just a really experience.
It felt like a waste of time. Your eyes hurt.
Right, exactly. A year later, I did a search on the Internet Archive, archive.org, and I found that and more.
It
was just within a year.
And archive.org is actually the host for this podcast, because they're one of the only sites that will let you upload as mm-hmm. much stuff as you want.
Yeah. And all their PDFs are searchable.
Yeah.
So no more scanning the journal the way that I did, just kind of flipping through pages, just put in the search term, and there it is.
So that's what, you know, what has been offered us is this kind of like infinite supply of material. But I think what we're talking about, and what we've been talking about in this episode so far, is kind of like, it needs the human touch, right? We have all the material now. All of it's accessible. Like a student can get on. I teach history, so I tell students all this information. This isn't like a class about historical information. You can find this stuff in a million different sources. We have to develop how we process the information, mm-hmm. right? We have to develop ways of the problem. In other words, is no longer finding the right material. Mm-hmm. The problem is what to do with a torrent of material.
Well, I think that really speaks to
but an opportunity maybe.
Well, that's the way that our mission as pedagogues, I think, has evolved, in the sense that it's not really about providing students with factual knowledge.
Mm.
If in a class, a student has a laptop or a tablet in front of them, they can access all the factual knowledge they want, right? So the important thing then becomes getting them to ask the right questions and making them make the factual knowledge they find kind of speak to the larger body of knowledge, and having one set of ideas speak to another set of ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really
mm-hmm.
where the challenge is.
Yeah.
You know, like for example, and you're teaching a content area course, it's like it doesn't really matter if you forget a certain date. You can get a student to find that date,
right?
Just do a Google search for that and find
right.
it. Okay, when did this happen? Well, I don't know. Let's find out. Let's look it up.
And in that context, it's weird to have a test at the end of the semester where it's like, what year was the Boston Massacre? You know, like that. It seems like that template. And I know that there are classes that are still doing that, right? I mean, we're not in a fully We're in a transitional moment.
Well, and the year that it happened is one of the less important things about that.
It's still important.
My point is that
it's accessible,
right? And it shouldn't. A student shouldn't walk away with an education where they're like, "Well, I learned the year of the Boston Massacre." Right. When it's like they're always going to be able to look that up on their phone.
Right.
You know, at a restaurant, and so you have this when you have a society that's walking around with devices in their pockets that can access basically the whole of human knowledge. The idea of a class that just kind of teaches you a couple bits of data to memorize seems mm-hmm. kind of old fashioned yeah. and weird. Really interesting stuff. I feel like we grew up at a time during. I remember. The Oregon Trail
we did not
grow up in a time that was free of technology, obviously, in the classroom. I bring that up because, do you guys remember Lemonade? Do you remember a game called Lemonade? I feel like I learned about entrepreneurial capitalism from this game Lemonade.
That's
where
right.
you had to basically I remember being maybe 8 years old and going down to the computer lab and learning computers, and obviously the administration of my elementary school in Ventura, California in the 1980s felt it was necessary that to get students starting to engage with digital technology, and this is obviously pre-web.
You remember Logo?
Logo, I don't remember.
No. That was like it was a very basic programming language, basically for kids. It was a graphical language. You had like a little turtle that was the cursor that mm-hmm. moved around doing stuff. Remember that?
And then QBasic. We were in high school. We were supposed to learn programming, and I think that was the thought was that you were going to need to learn that language.
Like
DOS,
10 print MS David DOS. Rules, 20 yeah. go to 10. Like
exactly.
That?
Yeah. Yeah. And you can make posters and games and things like that. But it's been interesting to kind of live during this moment, right? To like live and get up to the point where, you know, I didn't really plan to be in higher education when I was in elementary school, but at the same time, there's this kind of weird kind of continuum where you end up in a place with where technology is now part of a conversation of what you're doing with your mm-hmm. life. I mean, in a sense, I feel like things are changing so quickly that as an educator, I don't know what I'm going to be doing in 10 years. And that's kind of exciting.
That is exciting.
Yeah.
That's how it should be.
Yeah.
I mean, I've had professors in grad school who had these notebooks full of these yellowed notes.
Right.
Right? And they would use them for every single class. Mm-hmm. And they knew exactly what they'd be doing in 10 years.
We've still got professors like that.
They're still around.
I've heard of them. Luke and Mikhail, thank you so much. Do you have anything else, Luke?
No.
You want to wrap it up for us?
It's great. I've been listening to your podcast. I love it. I'm
Thanks.
A big fan. I love the kind of notions of power and being informed that run through everything you're doing. And
well, thanks. I mean, I wanted to get you guys in on this because I'm interested in human evolution in a sense. You know, I mean, I want to know kind of in hundreds of years, how will this moment be looked upon? I feel like we are living in a really critical transitional moment, and with education and technology is kind of one site where you can really really see that. Mm-hmm. You can see and you know there. I don't want to make it, again, you know, this dichotomy between the good and evil. We don't know where this is going, and obviously we'll probably end up in some sort of hybrid location. But either way, it's a really exciting time to be part of education right now,
yeah.
as we move forward with this internet experiment. So thanks, guys. I appreciate it.
Thanks, David.
Thanks, David.